It's okay, is it good? Okay, well, to start off on a military note, I was given orders to put Freud in the picture. So what do you do? I mean, in the picture of military medicine. What do? You go to the standard edition. Now, having gone through 22 or 23 volumes of it, I come up with 8.5 pages, actually, on military medicine. Now, as far as Freud and war is concerned, obviously, he was concerned, from 1914 onwards, he was concerned with the topic of war. It comes up all over his theoretical work, in Thoughts for the Times, on War and Death, on Transience, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, etc. But as far as the practice of military medicine is concerned, as I say, I come up with these 8.5 pages. And his contacts with military medicine per se divide into two episodes. And the first of them is an introduction he wrote, and you'll find this in volume 17, if you're interested in going to the standard edition. It's an introduction to the book Psychoanalysis and the War Neuroses. This is an interesting little volume. It came out of the 1918 Fifth Psychoanalytical Conference in Budapest, which was held just 2 months before the end of the war. Now, the previous conference, the fourth one, had been a debacle. In 1913, there was an international conference held in Munich, and it looked like it was going to be the last, and that psychoanalysis was finished at that point. This was when the Freudians came into an open battle with the Jungians and the Swiss. And the division in psychoanalysis became so extreme that all the Swiss left the movement. And at that point, this is 1913, Freud is already using sort of warlike metaphors of this conflict. This was a war. And he talks about, we have a bomb we're preparing for the Swiss, and this sort of language is going on. So he's at war there. 1918, just near the end of the war, and Budapest, it looks like things are getting better. The year starts well for Freud and for psychoanalysis, that the movement is given a big donation by a man called Anton von Freund, a Hungarian millionaire. This money is used to set up the press. So later on in the year, they have this conference in Budapest. It's held in a prestigious venue in the Academy of Science in Budapest. And they actually have official observers sent by the Austro-Hungarian government, two members of the medical staff are sent to observe because they're interested in psychoanalysis and the treatment of the war neurosis. So this is, in a way, a sort of success that the powers, the official, the governments are recognizing psychoanalysis at that point. And the Congress starts with a symposium on the war neurosis, psychoanalysis and the war neurosis. And there are three speakers. There's Sandor Ferenczi, Ernst Zimmel, and Karl Abraham. And they deliver these papers on their experience of the war neurosis as doctors in the Austro-Hungarian army. So these papers become this book that Freud introduced. Now, when he came to write the introduction, it was early 1919 and the war was over. So, as he says, the war was over and it seemed the war neuroses were over. Now, there's no concept then of post-traumatic stress, that the neuroses that they were talking of, and incidentally, they don't use the term shell shock at any point. This is all war neuroses, and it means symptoms that were either the result of what we call shell shock, or even other symptoms just from fear, fright, and so on, tremblings, physical symptoms. And they stopped when the war stopped, apparently. So Freud begins this introduction saying that sort of ruefully almost, you know, a great opportunity for observing this curious psychological phenomenon is over. And then he does at least add, but we wouldn't wish that this opportunity would recur, meaning that there'll be another war. So the practical point of the book is lost because the war is over, the neurosis is over. So Freud uses the introduction, in fact, for theoretical purposes. So he's concerned really with working out what the psychoanalytical sense of these neuroses were. And his main consideration is linking them up to libido theory, which is really the sexual etiology of the neurosis, which had been the cause of the split with the Jungians before the war, and it's the mainstay of psychoanalytical theory. And the problem about the war neuroses were that they didn't seem to have any clear sexual connotations. They're quite obviously caused by a traumatic shock, and therefore they link up with the peacetime traumatic neuroses that had been always a bit sidelined in theory because they did not yield to a psychoanalytic explanation very easily. They're more like what Freud called the actual neurosen, the actual neuroses, which are based on something in the present life of the person. Now, Freud is concerned about this failure to explain them because he says the psychiatrists are able to use that to refute the sexual etiology of neurosis in general. But he then comes up with a reason why the psychiatrists take this attitude, because by that point, psychiatry is actually yielding to the concept of the unconscious. It's widely accepted that there is an unconscious life, but not that there is a sexual etiology. And Freud says that the psychiatrists are mainly concerned with grave disorders such as paranoia, the dementia praecox, which we'd call schizophrenia, melancholia, which we'd call depression, all of which do not reveal the sexual etiology as clearly as the transference neurosis, which psychoanalysts are mainly concerned with. So his little sketch in this introduction is an attempt to show how in future, he doesn't actually achieve it here, he wants to map out in future how the war neuroses may be reconciled with the general psychoanalytical theory and primarily libido theory. Incidentally, he does make an interesting point in the introduction, which is that all these war neuroses could only occur in a conscript army. That this is the First World War was the first war with large conscript armies, that civilians drummed into the forces against their will. He says this would not occur in a professional army, these neuroses. So he's trying to bring libido theory into this theoretical sketch, and he comes up with something like it's an attempt to internalize this external trauma. And he comes up with a sketchy theory that the ego is split between the old wartime, the old peacetime ego of these unwilling soldiers and the wartime ego that's forced on them, and that there's an internal conflict between the two. And this still doesn't bring in libido in, so he comes up with this concept of narcissistic libido, which is sexual energy attached to the ego. So in this way, he's trying to draw a picture of a traumatic neurosis, which will have a sexual etiology behind the immediate cause, which is the shock. Now, this is, as I say, only a sketch, The essays themselves are concerned with practical medicine, but it has to be said that the main essay, the person who had the most practical experience of the war neuroses, was Ernst Zimmel, and his treatment isn't even really psychoanalytical. He's using cathartic treatment with even a bit of hypnosis, and Freud says, you know, this is sort of pre-psychoanalytical, but it's pointing in the right direction. And if we go to this paper by Ernst Zimmel, there's an interesting passage. Interesting because it just throws a sidelight on the treatment that these war neurosis soldiers were receiving at the time. I'll quote from Zimmel here. "Those doctors who have devised a system of tortures such as hunger cures, dark rooms, prohibition of letters, painful electric currents, etc., in order to extort from the patients the abandonment of their neurotic symptoms, unconsciously recognize the Freudian theory by the inversion of its fundamental principles. They make a torture of the treatment in order to force the neurotic to flee into health. The doctor schooled in psychoanalysis does not need to hound in the opposite direction his patients who have been driven into illness." This is the Freudian flight into illness. "He releases him from the fetters of the unconscious mind and thus is in the position to guide the neurotic into health and save him." Now, this term that he uses there, he's talking about electric treatment and torture, that brings me to the second episode in Freud's two contacts with military medicine. So if you go to volume 17 of the collected works, you'll find there's an appendix to this introduction, and it's entitled Memorandum on the Electrical Treatment of War Neurosis. Now, this is a document that Freud wrote in 1920, and it was to be submitted to what was called a commission for inquiry into violations of military duty during the war. Now, after the war, now in 1918 was the end, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been ignominiously defeated, was broken up, Austria was now a tiny republic. And there was a general feeling of, you know, something went wrong. What are we going to do about it? I mean, this is less truth and reconciliation than shame and blame. And there were thousands of accusations going about. I mean, the Austro-Hungarian army had a reputation. I think some historians have said it was the most inefficient and ineffective war machine in the history of mankind. I think words to that effect. So people were feeling angry, and this commission was an attempt to deal with it. And there were thousands of accusations thrown at this commission, which was not a law court. It was a commission in order to sift out which accusations were worthy of legal prosecution. And one of them was against the very eminent psychiatrist Julius Wagner Jauregg, who was the director of the Vienna University Psychiatric Clinic. And it's alleged he had used electrical treatment, which was a treatment of the time, as torture. So the specific grievance, the case where Freud was called in, was an accusation by a man called Caudas, Lieutenant Walter Caudas, who had written a diary of his experiences under Wagner Jauregg. And these had been published in a social democratic journal under the title Electrical Torture in 1919. And so his case had to be reviewed, really, because it had been made public. And he was called to testify, and Freud was called in as an expert witness. Now, the founder of the Sigmund Freud Archives, K.R. Eisler, has written a book on this, And much of what I'm going to say is going to be based on the book rather than the memorandum. Now, in fact, the memorandum as it was published was never meant to be published by Freud. It was dug up from the archives. It was simply an official paper he gave for the commission. And it was dug up in about 1950 and published for the first time then. And in fact, it was probably never used in the hearing itself. As far as we can see from the transcript, it was submitted to the chair of the committee, and Freud had wanted it to be read out in the hearing, and it may not have been. It looks as if it wasn't. What Eisler digs up is the actual transcript of the hearing itself, which he publishes in the book, and which is going to furnish me most of the material for what I've got to say. So this Cowders, we know a lot more about him than Freud did as a result of Eisler's investigation. What happened is he actually came to know the man in the 1940s and 50s in New York. So he was able to get his story and write his point of view, which gives us a whole new slant on the trial, which Freud did not have. He'd only heard his deposition the few minutes before giving his evidence. So what happened to Cowders is he was a volunteer when the war broke out in 1914, and within a few weeks of the war breaking out, he suffered shell shock. He was in a blast, was buried alive, as many were, and as a result, he suffered all sorts of symptoms afterwards. He had lethargy, depressions, headaches, difficulties in movement. He was invalided out at that point, and then he went to work in a publisher for the rest of the war. And then you come to 1917, a critical point. I mean, the war is being lost by the Central Powers. And so all people invalided out were being reviewed. He was called in for examination, and that's how he ended up being examined by Wagner Jauregg, who obviously suspected Cowders of malingering. Now, as expert witness, Freud's brief was to say whether he thought that the treatment Cowders received in Jauregg's clinic was warranted and justifiable. Now, it has to be said that apart from being given electrical treatment, Cowders was also locked up for 77 days, most of that in solitary confinement. Now, Freud's witnessing was a curious matter. The other incident, the introduction to the War Neuroses book, was, as I said, just used for theoretical speculation. This witness involved him on a much deeper level. It involved him personally, professionally, and socially. And the reason for that is he is facing Wagner Jauregg, one of the opponents of psychoanalysis, in a very public position. Not only that, he has had a relationship, let's say. He has known Wagner Jauregg for 40 years. In some respects, Wagner Jauregg is a sort of alter ego or doppelganger for Freud. They have parallel, their careers are in parallel. They're exact contemporaries. They were both research neurologists at the university. Both of them worked in the research laboratory of Salomon Stricker in the 1880s. So they had history, these two men. Now, Wagner Jauregg, in his position as director of the clinic, was hostile to psychoanalysis, but polite and restrained. He never came out publicly against it, though everybody knew he was. And he, like I said, he was a sort of doppelganger of Freud. He had come into psychiatry more or less by accident. He says it himself in his memoirs. There was a time when both he, in the 1880s, when both Freud and Wagner Jauregg are on the cusp of becoming psychoanalysts. Psychiatrists. Keep them apart. Psychiatrists. Freud was working in Meinert's psychiatric clinic at the university, and he was angling for a job at that time. He was engaged to be married. He had to find a profession, and he was actually considering psychiatry, and he was hoping, I think, to take over from Meinert. And then word gets round on the grapevine to him that Jews are never going to get promoted to director of psychiatric department. Now, he wasn't too cut up about the loss of that career. He was already disillusioned with psychiatry at that time. But at the same time, Wagner Jauregg is accidentally offered a job in psychiatry. And as he said, he had no vocation for it. He was really, like Freud, by vocation, a research scientist. So they're really sort of alter egos. Now, when Freud came onto that commission, in effect, he had Wagner Jauregg as expert witness. He had Wagner Jauregg at his mercy. He could have laid into him. But he made a personal political decision not to do so. He says, there's a little phrase from a letter to Ferenczi just at that time, "I will treat him," as Jauregg, "with the clearest benevolence. There's also nothing he could do about it." Now, nothing he could do about it, what he means there is that, in a sense, Wagner Jauregg was the fall guy for his everything that went on in his clinic. He, as director, was responsible for what his subordinates were doing. Now, Freud is, it seems, convinced that Wagner Jauregg personally, who he respected at a distance, was not personally involved in these alleged malpractices. And Freud actually says, he says to the hearing, "I'm convinced he could not have been involved personally. I cannot answer for his colleagues and subordinates." When colleagues or ex-colleagues of Freud heard about how he acted on the hearing, there was differences in attitude. One very much ex-colleague, Adler, was appalled. He said, "You know, why didn't Freud go for the jugular at that point when he had him at his mercy?" He said, "There's no place for nobility when you're faced with such enemies as these." But Wagner Jauregg wasn't an enemy in that sense. He never, as I said, came up publicly against psychoanalysis, unlike others, people in his clinic, who had actually been involved in ad hominem attacks on Freud, and publicly ridiculed psychoanalysis, people like Riemann. Now, Freud wasn't going to get into that. And in one point in the transcript, he actually talks of my friend Jauregg. So he's establishing a sort of relationship with him. On that matter, it should be mentioned that the year before, Freud applied to become ordinary professor at the university. Now, he'd been a professor at the university, like Jauregg, since 1902. Only he was Freud was an extraordinary professor, and Jauregg was an ordinary professor. Now, I mean, it sounds as if extraordinary is much better than ordinary, but in fact, what extraordinary means is that you're really outside the academic establishment, and an ordinary professor is much higher, has much higher status and rank. So in 1919, Freud applied for an ordinary professorship, and Wagner Jauregg actually signed a letter saying that he should be promoted. So, curious relationship. I mean, there is a little side theme to that, that when this letter was dug out of the archives, the draft of Jauregg's letter, there was a very curious slip of the pen. He said Freud should be appointed to extraordinary professorship, so unconsciously meaning he should stay where he was. But I'm sure that would have been corrected in the final version. Anyway, so all of this makes it a pretty touchy situation personally, politically, professionally for Freud confronting Wagner Jauregg at that point. Now, this also raises a couple of questions about Freud's appearance at this hearing. And the first of it is why Freud was summoned. Now, in the Jones biography of Freud, Jones says this proves the status of psychoanalysis in Vienna at that point. And Freud's personal status. Now, I've said Freud had no personal experience of war neuroses. There were plenty of other people in the medical establishment who had far greater experience, who could have been more expert witnesses. But the point of that is that they would have been people in the medical establishment. They would have had some well-known close relationship to Jauregg. So the chair of the hearing, who is a lawyer, is looking for someone who can't be accused of such bias. It was well known that they were ideological or theoretical opponents. So Freud was chosen more because he was an opponent, ideologically and theoretically, of Wagner than because of any status of psychoanalysis. In fact, what Eisler says, and I'd agree with that, is that Freud was seen as not necessarily as of high status, but as of a representative of what anachronistically we could call anti-psychiatry. So he would be the best person to be seen as objective or not even objective, almost, again, as evidence for the prosecution. But coming back to his relationship with Jauregg, why did he not refuse? It wasn't a court of law. He couldn't be subpoenaed. So he could have refused. In fact, many eminent people did refuse to appear on these commissions. And given what I've said about him treating Wagner-Jauregg well, it seems that one reason might have been his sense of justice, that he was, in fact, trying to exculpate Wagner as a person. Apart from that, there is the thing that it would bring psychoanalysis to public attention. I mean, these were public hearings held in the House of Parliament in the Vienna government buildings. They were reported in the press. So it was good publicity as well. So he had another motive. Now, the hearing itself, Loeffler, who was the chair, was not concerned, really, of this quibble between psychoanalysis and psychiatry. What he's trying to get at is the central issue, is the electrotherapy, is it treatment or torture? As simple as that. Now, given that, Freud is in another delicate situation in speaking about electrical treatment, which obviously he didn't approve of at that point, or the other treatments. And I mean, there's in defending Wagner, you can see he can't keep on that line. There's certain cases where he's faltering in his evidence. For instance, when Cowders, the victim, says to him, what does he think of being kept in 77 days, most of it in solitary, in confinement? Does he not think that would be harmful, if not torture? And Freud hums and haws at that point and says, of course it was unpleasant, but it was without risk, which is a highly doubtful assertion, you have to say, at the least. As far as the actual electrotherapy is concerned, now it has to be said this is not electric shocks. It isn't ECT. It isn't just plugging and contact into the mains. It is using what's called faradic or galvanic current, which is what you get is a sliding current from just very low. You can regulate the current given, so it can go from a sort of slight tingling to a real electric shock. So the argument here is on the side of Wagner-Jauregg is that this electrotherapy, which was part of the armament of any doctor at the time, and in fact when Freud started up in his practice in 1886, he says, you know, I must get an electric machine. No neurologist would have been taken seriously who didn't have one. So it was current practice to use electric current. By the end of the 19th century, Freud is already disillusioned with electricity, and in his memoirs he says it was complete nonsense, the idea that it could be of any therapeutic value. But he can't condemn it outright as such. But Wagner... 5 minutes, is it right? Okay, we'll gallop through the rest. Wagner Jauregg, he himself is in a bit of a fix over justifying it, because he has to say we were only using low currents. And on the other hand, it's obvious that this treatment was just to drive so-called malingerers, and he clearly suspected Cowders of malingering, back into the forces by making the treatment more unpleasant than the war itself. So the question here is where Freud stands on all of this in the end. Now, there's a moral point here which Freud brings up in the hearing, and that relates to military medicine in general. He says that the physician's responsibility is ultimately the patient's interest. However, if a physician is under orders, as Jauregg was, or any of these people, they are losing sight of their true duty as doctors. So that's one aspect. The chairman actually challenged Freud at one point and says, do you use electricity in private practice? And Freud responds, in private practice, one tries not to be disagreeable. Otherwise, one is replaced by a colleague who is less so. Naturally, this motive does not operate for physicians employed by the government. So at one level, this duel between, I call it duel between Wagner, Jauregg and Freud, is... about the subject that they're treating, and it's about the limit of their will. Whether the patient wills himself to be ill or is a malingerer, wills themselves to be ill or is a neurotic. And Freud comes out with this: all neurotics are malingerers, they simulate without knowing it, and this is their sickness. We have to keep in mind there's a big difference between conscious refusal and unconscious refusal. The conscious and unconscious always conjoin in the individual. If I confront a neurotic who claims to believe that he's organically ill with a statement he's not, he'll be offended, because it's partly true. Right, that's the all I have time for here. I mean, I have to say that at one point... at several points in the hearing, the chair says, only medical details, please. Now, obviously, the medical details are contingent on the practice and defined by the intentions of the physician. So what we see here is a confrontation between a doctor in private practice who is aware of all his duties to the patient, and someone who is under orders. So at a higher level of abstraction, we can look on this little confrontation as a medical fable. And since I've relied on Ice Law all along, I'll finish with a little quote from him. Quote, "It is not known whether anyone in the courtroom saw clearly that Wagner, Jauregg and Freud were facing each other as representatives of two different worlds. One representing the point of view of expediency, and the other that of humanity, which sees in man the sufferer caught in the toils of fate." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. And we've even got time for one question.
If Freud thought that neurosis only occurred in conscript armies, what did he think of the psychology of volunteer soldiers? Did he think they were impervious to it?
Of the volunteers?
Yeah.
Well, there is a question there that when he said that, this was before the hearing and before he'd met Cowders, who did volunteer, you see. So in effect, Cowders does sort of contradict that line. I mean, he's feeling, as I said in this introduction to the War Neuroses, he's feeling his way towards a theory. He's not laying down the law. But yes, I mean, Cowder's case does in fact, he doesn't go into a psychoanalysis of Cowder's, I should say, at any point, but he does treat him as both physically injured and neurotic. But this might be part of this line he's trying to draw, you know, not to, I mean, as I've tried to bring in the whole affair with Wagner Jauregg to show that there were all sorts of other considerations, non-psychological and, you know, right outside this, that were operating on this particular instance. But yes, theoretically it doesn't quite fit, does it?
Thank you.
Okay.
Very much. We're now going to move straight on to a different time era, but we've got Tom Harrison, who I'm very pleased to introduce. Tom is a medical historian who's researching a PhD in the history of medicine at the University of Birmingham, but Tom has also worked previously as a consultant psychiatrist, a consultant social psychiatrist, for over 28 years. Tom's actively involved in the Royal College of Psychiatrists, serving on the committees at the Rehabilitation and Social Psychiatry Faculty, Public Education, and the Patients and Carers Committees. He's published widely, and in particular, he's author of Beyond Rickman, Fulkes, and the Northfield Experiments. And his present research is on the Ingeborg therapeutic community. Tom's title is talk today is Strange Meetings at Northfield, Dilemmas of Psychiatry War.
Thank you very much. Just quickly get the gadget sorted. Hello. Can everybody hear me? Lovely. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak at this conference. My title, Strange Meetings, encompasses two different subjects. The first is the Wilfred Owen poem from the First World War. Its description of a rendezvous with the enemy after death is a redolent embodiment of some of the emotional effects of combat. The second concerns the group therapy practice at Northfield Military Hospital during the Second World War. And much of the following is culled from the transcripts of discussions there by psychiatrists, perhaps the first of their kind anywhere in the world. In 1945, Lieutenant Colonel Mayne was faced with a conundrum. Amongst his patients at Northfield Military Hospital were a number of men who'd been tank commanders. They were depressed and refused to go on fighting. They'd become remote, standoffish, and dismissive of basewallers such as Mayne, and treated him like dirt. They'd seen it all. They'd lost two or three crews of their comrades with whom they'd shared the intimacy of the confines of their vehicle. A tank brewing up gave the commander who was reserving from the turret time to escape unharmed physically. The second in command, if he was unlucky, might also escape, but usually with fatal burns. The other men were incinerated. What was he to do for these unapproachable men? His response, and interestingly this reflects a little bit Werner Jauregg, was to confine them to one room with 23 hours of darkness out of 24 on a diet of bread and water, with the command to bloody well cry, mate. His colleague, Dr. Dewar, was still upset about recording this half a century later. The poet Vernon Scannell, a later patient at Northfield, on hearing of this in 1992, raged apoplectically against the man, showing not a trace of doubt or sympathy, and imagined his soft hands like pastry dough, how they spit and sizzle in the glow inside the turret of a brewed-up tank. What was the setting for this apparent barbarity? Well, we've first of all got to explore the task that faced the military psychiatrist, and then examine his or her response. I've chosen to focus this essay on the work of the military hospital at Northfield, mainly because it confines the range of potential psychiatric roles in the Second World War to those of assessment and treatment, and second, because I have some knowledge and have had interviews with various people who've been there. Northfield Military Hospital was taken over in 1942 to treat soldiers suffering from neurotic conditions who had already undergone treatment elsewhere in the British Army. It subsequently gained fame as one of the origins of the therapeutic community movement, where Bion, Rickman, Bridger, Main, Beerer, Anson, Creek, Bradbury, Fuchs all worked and gained subsequent fame in their various fields of endeavour. And many, of course, are psychoanalysts, both at the time or subsequently. It was a medium-sized Victorian asylum on the outside skirts of Birmingham, described by one soldier as very large. I've seen bigger, but large. Brick, and I think brick-tiled roof, red-tiled roof. Very obviously a jail or a mental asylum. Slightly heavy. I won't say menacing or foreboding or anything imaginative like that. Just a damn dreary-looking brick building. It's important to note that it was a military hospital, subject to military discipline. The senior officer was a colonel from the British Army. At the time of Tom Main, it was Colonel Rolette, who was actually a radiologist from the Royal Army Medical Corps and wasn't necessarily a psychiatrist. There was a sergeant in charge of discipline, for instance. There were between 200 to 600 soldier patients, and most of the staff also resided in the hospital, normally serving only 600 patients. It could be very crowded at times. On one occasion, soldiers slept in tents in the grounds during a very cold November, and at other times had to sleep in the corridors. British military services have routinely underestimated the emotional effects of service life on recruits or conscripts. The legacy of the First World War was that 120,000 men were awarded pensions for their combat-related neuroses. Yet by the onset of the Second World War, there were only just six doctors who had any psychiatric experience at all in the British Army. Yet between 1941 April and October 1943, a period of 2.5 years, there were 350,000 outpatients psychiatry. And so they had to recruit a great deal number of doctors very rapidly to serve the army in that time. Whilst the underlying disorders that the men suffered replicated those seen in peacetime, their expression was different. As Lewis and Slater reported, the clinical pictures exhibited did not fit cleanly into the recognised syndrome. In the same patient, there would be evidence of hysteria, anxiety, depression, and of a paranoid and resentful attitude. Brown found that army psychiatrists are often perplexed when they attempt to fit individual cases into the descriptions of the official nomenclature. Main described those at Northfield as falling into a number of different groups. There was the lonely homesick man, insecurity, showing anxiety and hysterical illness, who is sometimes before he's even been in battle, whilst others carried out their social obligations in the face of fantastic dangers until their sense of security has gone. Some had borne their emotional pain, supported by comrades up until they themselves died. Still others had killed too much or lost men through errors of judgment. The effects might be so severe for them to become hallucinated and deluded. Some were mute, shaking uncontrollably, or so wound up that when attending the local factory for rehabilitation, the sounds of the machines would trigger off panic attacks as they re-experienced the noise of the battlefield. A number committed suicide. They were sent there, having been through other psychiatric assessments, and were already well established in their sick role and more resistant to treatment. Many were seen as working their ticket, i.e. getting out of the army, browned off or scrimshankers. All were demoralised and separated from their comrades in arms. Thorner, a later Northfieldian, however, argued that the average British soldier is not unwilling to serve and would fare better if they were convinced that everything was being done to ensure that they could do so in a role that suited their abilities. Supporting his contention was the fact that there was at least one patient at Northfield who'd won the Victoria Cross, and many others who'd been decorated for similar acts of courage. there's been a lot, significant and important literature on the emotional and psychological effect of combat and military life on the soldier. Less attention has been paid to the doctors, except perhaps to talk about doctors' minds in the abstract or discuss psychiatry if it was sort of monolithic societal power. Antipathy is nothing new to the profession. Prime Minister Winston Churchill inveighed against these gentlemen who are capable of doing immense amount of harm with what they may very easily degenerate into charlatanry. Such attitudes were also prevalent in the army. J.R. Rees reported that we were often told that psychiatrists were the fifth columnists of the army. Similar criticisms persisted throughout the conflict. Their effect was evident by Stalker, writing in 1945, when he had to defend his actions, lest it be thought that a psychiatrist's report is an easy way out of military service for the shirker. Most psychiatrists were civilian recruits, and were young and inexperienced both in life and their special subject. At least 10 years too young, according to one, referring to himself. Unhelpfully, they were enjoined by Evans at the outbreak of war to take pains to determine that our own thoughts are of courage, confidence, faith and hope. We must sedulously refuse every thought of fear, regret, resentment and the like, because those thoughts arouse emotions that have a weakening effect. Once in the army, their training ranged from between 6 to 12 weeks before having responsibility for treatment and disposal. Contemporary civilian psychiatry was made up of two basic disciplines, asylum work or private practice. There was little or no training in outpatient work, and in either case, the limited therapies available were rarely effective. Eugenic arguments held sway, locating the cause of disorder in heredity. Curran and Gutman pronounced that many of the men who develop psychiatric disorders are only reliable and unsatisfactory individuals. The physical stature of soldiers arriving at Slater's hospital was measured as part of a research program to assess the relationship of their physiognomy to their personality. In the RAF, the psychiatrists were obliged to assess whether the men suffered from LMF, lack of moral fiber. Davidson at Northfield reflected these views, recalling the good material we had after D-Day, presumably as opposed to the bad material otherwise. Thorner, again, amongst others, disputed this viewpoint and considered that some neurotics actually gained efficiency from their neurotic makeup in the army. The doctors themselves were not always free of conflicts, of difficulties. Robertson and Moore in 1947 found that they'd had a high degree of psychosis and psychopathy, probably due to the less stringent selection criteria for them entering the army. Turning to what the roles were, in discussion at Northfield, Creek outlined three main roles military psychiatrists had to undertake: army officer, medical officer, and as an individual. And I've listed up here a number of the different aspects of being a psychiatrist. I'm not going to go through each of those individually, but pick out some of them as they relate to working at Northfield. And it's worth noting that owing to the chronicity of the conditions affecting the men and their distance from the battlefield, extreme measures were not applicable to Northfield. However, the psychiatrists would still have, as their primary purpose, keeping soldiers on the job, which most of them did not willingly choose, and for which most are not prepared mentally and emotionally, a job which is replete with displeasure, monotony, separation from home, to say nothing of the hardships of mud, cold and exhaustion, and the impending hazards of death and disfigurement. The responses of some psychiatrists can be gleaned from the technical memorandum provided to every psychiatrist. After being instructed that the army is a military organisation and that every man in the army is first and foremost a soldier, it was emphasised that the guiding principles in recommending the future allocation of a soldier were to consider not what was best for the soldier, but what was best for the army and what is possible in the army. Whilst urging that the army psychiatrist's effectiveness depends on his reports, the author disparagingly reflected on his own experience. Reports are issued for the guidance of unit medical officers, records offices, branches of the War Office and medical boards. They will find diffuseness wearisome, theory frequently ludicrous, and jargon unhelpful. It was also irrelevant to record the scandalous, e.g. that the soldier is masturbating, illegitimate, or homosexual. In summary, their effort was to be directed at wherever possible to fitting men for military duties after a period of psychiatric breakdown. To achieve this task required discernment and a delicate balance of many factors. This wasn't easy. Tom Main joined up as a young psychiatrist to cure suffering humanity and organize so that soldiers would get better from my nice medical care. And the army didn't give a bug about me and these interests of mine. The army was interested in something else. It wanted to win the war. It wanted an efficient army and to be an efficient machine to meet the huge threat of another very efficient machine. He lambasted other doctors at Northfield who he considered to be traitors. They wanted to pursue this selfish interest of theirs when there were bloody great issues to be resolved. Goldman similarly maintained that the doctor could no longer have a narcissistic investment in his hard-won cures. Main continued in another paper that the psychiatrist wished, understandably, to feel important and useful. As a result, the sense of the safety of his job could lead to a defensive swashbuckling or a guilt-driven compassion for others who have to undertake the risks of death in battle. Sentimentality and anger about neurotic soldiers commonly influence clinical judgment in prognosis and disposable. The urge to act too much as the military man, sending soldiers back to duty instead of coddling them, would result in an outcry from front-line officers who would find themselves laden with all sorts of misfits. An American doctor, Needles, was obliged to listen in while a dynamic, chest-thumping psychiatrist who had never been exposed to anything more devastating than a toy pistol embarked on a pep talk number 3 and harangued a combat-ridden soldier about the necessity of standing up like a man. Needles reflected, one was led to wonder what incentive spurred on these stethoscopic heroes. Beyond summed up his view of the role, which was to produce self-respecting men, socially adjusted to the community, and therefore willing to accept his responsibilities in peace or war. The soldiers, of course, weren't automatically going to accept this. Their view of the task that lay before them varied from the desired through to the army. They might be mute, or may be able to unable to explain themselves, rendered numb by shock. Some were ashamed that they let themselves down. Others felt hard done by, and blamed all and sundry for the situation. Sharman, as a military lawyer, was critical of the psychiatrist's tendency to accept far too readily the raw deals that the soldiers offered. A careful and thorough examination may lead to an exaggerated compassion with the soldier and an urge to protect him. And this brings up the concept of non-combatant guilt, which Beyond described as one of the difficulties facing a psychiatrist who's treating combatant soldiers is his feeling of guilt that he's trying to bring a state of mind in which they will have to face dangers, not excluding loss of life, that he himself is not called on to face. McKeith says that the doctor had to be professionally aware of how the irrational responses to this non-combatant guilt could influence his work. And he emphasized that young doctors were particularly vulnerable to this. At Northfield, Golding was concerned that his successful band of brothers, whom he'd been treating, were about to be broken up by the exigencies of disposal back to army life, and he found it very difficult to cope with this. Unit officers could also exert inappropriate pressure. Posner described the young psychiatrist, who has not learned to evaluate objectively all the available information concerning his patients, who would be more likely to yield to strong suggestions from senior officers to recommend the invalidating of quasi-psychiatric grounds of personnel for whom they wish to take no further responsibility. Elaborated. Officers have a penchant for describing commonplace misbehaviour in sensational psychological jargon. The opportunist sneak thief who steals a wallet from the barrack room or breaks open the church offertory box is called a kleptomaniac. A soldier urinating near a public thoroughfare will be described as an exhibitionist. The solution for some doctors was to detach the military from the so-called real life. Rickman and Bion observed one session in which their colleague opened with the words, "You can say what you like here, for here in these four walls we're not in the army." Creek also complained that the life in the armed forces was artificial, and it is clear that for many it was an unwelcome break to their personal proper careers. Many would have been ambivalent in challenging the wishes of those in their care who wanted to leave as well. Not unnaturally, this attitude began to prevail after the cessation of hostilities. And in one of the discussions, Main reacted by insisting, "What is this? Why is this difficulty in therapy? The situation is a real one, and men can be told that men like him are needed." As Martins emphasized, "We are the staff. We have to adjust ourselves before expecting the patients to do it." The emphasis that Rickman and Bion placed on the realities of here and now rather than in-depth psychotherapy aimed to counter this splitting. They were often working under pressure. Lieutenant Harris reported having 60 to 70 patients on one ward. He complained that he had 5 new patients to see and report on in under an hour. Bion, on his arrival at Northfield, was immediately beset with urgent problems posed by importunate soldiers and others. The rank and class of the psychiatrist is another issue. The soldier patient had to address the doctor as sir, just as he would any other senior officer. Similarly, he would also have to take any treatment prescribed as an order. Lieutenant Magnus raised the issues of men disliking being addressed and addressing people of senior rank. Rickman tackled the distinction between physician, patient, and officer and other ranks early on in his ward by discussing openly as a real here and now issue, rather than fudging it as his colleague referred to earlier had done. Listening to the doctors of that time speaking on film, or even later when being interviewed, their voices and body language exhibit a similar urbane manner, speaking King's English, laconic and confident, a world apart from those people they're addressing in terms of patients. At times they issue orders as part of treatment, for instance, whilst the soldier is under sedation, to which, of course, the soldier has to respond in the appropriate manner. The changes at Northfield attempted to combat some of these status issues. Tom Bain described a review of our attitudes as psychiatrists towards our own status and responsibilities. The hierarchical rights of the doctors have to be exchanged for a more sincere role of a member in a real community. Patients are no longer his captive children, obedient in nursery-like activities, but have sincere adult roles to play, and are free to reach for responsibilities and opinions concerning the community of which they are a part. In attempting to implement this on his ward, he insisted that all the doctors should consult the nurse before initiating any action. Dewar's response, who was one of the other doctors, was to ignore the instruction, and Main had to give this approach up in the light of this sort of reaction. He granted later that he perhaps tried to go too far, given the cultural expectations of the time. Another impression given by the films, both American and British, is that physical methods of treatment help the doctor to avoid making real contact with the patient's distress. Hypnosis and suggestive methods of barbiturates concentrated on the immediate psychological and physical symptoms. Group and psychotherapeutic work, on the other hand, meant that the doctor was faced with hearing the stories and tragedies without the defensive barrier of a white coat. Group work for nearly all of those at Northfield was an entirely new experience, and they had to work out methods of surviving the emotional trauma as they experienced it. As McLean expressed it, "I started off with a resistance to the idea of groups. I think the reason was a personal one, encouraged to some extent by other psychiatrists. I was rather suffering from the conception that a psychiatrist must be someone who is omniscient in the psychological field. Periods of the patient, who must be a psychological god. I found that I couldn't maintain that attitude and felt very insecure, and my natural reaction was to give up groups. I was unwilling to expose myself and my weaknesses to a group of patients. Bion argued that group work was a way of facing the neurotic treat that the men were experiencing. He recalled the issue of non-combatant guilt referred to earlier and stated that any psychiatrist who attempts to make group study their own tensions as a therapeutic occupation is in today's term stopping a retreat and as a result may be shot at. But he will lose some of his feelings of guilt. It was a shock for the doctors to find out that the social methods implemented by Harold Bridger in the social therapy department appeared to be more effective than their psychotherapy. These activities would be practical group activities with a shared purpose, such as running a newspaper, running the hospital band, or making toys for the local children, local children's centres. This gave the soldiers experiencing group cohesion, enhancing their sense of self-worth and attachment, in a seemingly greater way than exploring their emotional difficulties in therapy. Davidson was anxious that this was so successful that there is a danger that psychiatry will not be not necessary if social therapy spreads. Okay, having reviewed all these difficulties, let's return to the conundrum facing Tom Maine. Did he exercise discernment and a delicate balancing of many factors in prescribing compulsory mourning? He was a man preaching democracy, belongingness, and concern to treat patients as adults. It's worth pointing out the foods. On being confronted with a soldier who was bothered by his homicidal wishes whilst in Northfield, instructed him to go and kill the cats that were plaguing the hospital. The man was later found feeding and caring for his new four-legged acquaintances. As you will know, paradoxically, he has had its vogue in recent times. When telling this story about the tank commanders, there are a couple of other issues to report. First is Maine's attitude towards the soldiers, the tank commanders. In his words, they were high-quality people, and they were quite decent soldiers. I don't want to make them heroic, which suggests at least some degree of ambivalence about his wish to idealise them. Second, when relating the incident, he paused during the recital and was observed by myself and my people who were with me to be crying. All this suggests that Scannell's observations concerning his callousness were misplaced. Perhaps a more caring doctor would have wanted to act more conservatively, with reassurance, and continue attempts at psychotherapy, and maybe add some sedation. The result, quite probably, would have been to allow them to continue in their isolated hell. The psychiatrist might have attempted abreaction, injecting a barbiturate, and either giving them instructions to forget the whole affair, or elaborate on what had happened. This had a mixed reputation, with deaths being associated with it, and also the release of emotions becoming quite traumatic in themselves. Continuous narcosis was a further alternative, but this again had serious side effects with patients experiencing psychotic phenomena. Maine eschewed all these approaches. Reporting on the events 40 years later, he was still of the view that the treatment was successful, although he had changed his opinion on continuous narcosis, which he had favoured at the time. I think it's very interesting how Vernon Scannell writes this poem on hearing about it, perhaps in exactly the same way as the tank commanders felt about Tom Maine. In other words, they exploded with anger at his callousness and cruelty, but at least they were starting to talk. Jones and Wesley wisely summed up their research into military psychiatry, stating that there's no single answer to any of these questions, just a series of different approaches and viewpoints. I suspect that Maine's approach will provoke many of these for years to come. Thank you. Oh, this is John Rickman as done by one of the patients at Northfield, and it's, you may not be able to read it, it's the Freudian Rickman Rorschach, just to make sure I was doing something about psychoanalysis. It's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you very much, Tom. And you've even given us some time for questions. So, last question?
Okay. Again?
Yes.
Sorry. The advice to Bloody Well Cry wasn't necessarily wrong then.
I think it's very difficult to know. I personally, I do wonder what I'd have done in the circumstances. I hope I would have had the courage of Tom Main, because I think that took a lot of courage to tell these people to do that. Because I think otherwise they may well have left the army still mute, still bunged up emotionally. I think it was an approach that had more chance of success than the other ones. But I don't know whether I'd have the courage to do it.
I thought that was a nicely human response there. But is there any tracking of what happened to these people, whether what worked, what didn't work?
Follow-up in the Second World War is very poor, not unnaturally. Some follow-up for people who are at the civilian resettlement units, which were based on the work that was done at Northfield, and that was moderately successful. There is also follow-up of soldiers who discharged from Slater and Mill Hill, which is where the more traditional psychiatrists are working. And the outcome for people who left the British Army during the time of war was fairly uniformly awful. They deteriorated, and Main and Brion and Rickman and all the Tavistock group would have said, but the real problem was they were losing their comradeship, their group of people they were working with. And that's one of the things that people, when we think of doing psychiatry, and I think these psychiatrists often fail to understand, it wasn't actually about treating the individual, it's often treating the group. And so, but no, the follow-up is pretty poor.
Necessarily be broken up at some point.
What people tried to get over, Main and people tried to get over at Hollymore, was that you tried to get people to learn to be in groups, so you could take those skills elsewhere. So it's a capability, not a therapy, if you see what I mean. We can't. There's certainly no follow-up. The first experiment at Northfield, John Rickman was there for perhaps 6 months. Beyond was there for 6 weeks. And the whole of the first Northfield experiment is... the only evidence about it is the papers that they wrote, and that very first paper, Tensions, and a couple of other papers. So there's no follow-up from them at all. But the little bit of evidence that seems to be going around is that although the story is that they were sacked because the men were... there's a lot of mythology around why they left. One of the stories is promoted by Pat DeMarais was the place was getting into a mess. Let's be honest, Northfield was a mess anyway. You've got 600 to 800, 600 soldiers milling about with lots of people there. So the mess side of it is, and there was some evidence, albeit from, I think, from Beon or Rickman himself, that the place was actually getting tidier as a result of the work they were doing. There was a lot of misconceptions about what, from the other doctors there, what they were doing. They thought they were into doing in-depth psychotherapy, but in fact they weren't. They were doing exactly what was actually getting the soldiers to face the here and now situation.
So,
said that young doctors were especially susceptible to non-combatant guilt. I wonder why this was thought. Why it was thought that young doctors were...
If you'd... It wasn't... Most of the people joining the British Army were young doctors. Tom Main was very young at the time, and it was their experience. I mean, McKeith, who I mentioned, was in charge of military psychiatry in North Africa, and was overall in charge. So his viewpoint was seeing these young doctors. Posner was writing after the war and was writing back about his own experiences. And I think it's actually, I can't remember if it's Posner who actually says, they were much too young, 10 years too young, including me. You know, I've given you a whole lot of ideas about what the difficulties are facing an ordinary psychiatrist going into the British Army. You have to shift your thinking dramatically. In Tom Main, talks about his shift that he had to make, that he wanted to cure people, but the British Army wasn't interested in that side of things. Frankly, the British Army was wanting to win the war. And for most of us, that's a very tough call. I mean, I'm obviously, I suspect it comes over, I'm highly sympathetic to the Tom Main and Tavistock approach to it, which is that, frankly, you've got to make... In certain circumstances, I had to cut a quote out, which was on D-Day. Frankly, if the soldier survives 6 hours more fighting, you got them back doing that 6 hours more fighting. Whether you did not think about what the effects on them were. But that's a tough call for young doctors coming in full of ideals, like I hopefully was.
Were the groups specifically for officers and other ranks? And if so, are there any recordings of the outcome differences between these groups?
I'm afraid there's no outcome recordings of any of this. It's purely... So we'll put that one to one side. There was a small group of officers in Northfield who were treated in a separate ward away from the other ranks. So all the group work that was done... because Ronald Markilly, who actually looked after the officers, didn't do any group work, as far as I know, although he became a psychoanalyst after the war. All the rest of the group work was done with officers as doctors, with the patients being men. And so that's the real reason for Rickman's comment, that, you know, let's deal with this as a real here and now issue. Yeah, it's true. I get paid more, you've got this, etc., rather than saying, sorry, we're not in the army here, I'm a real doctor now.
If even the cook was a man, were there any women at all?
I've cut that bit out. Five of the doctors were women, and I really would very much like to find out their views. I did actually interview Millicent Dewar, I got something from her anyway. But Davidson, who I mentioned, Mildred Creek, there's a lady called Toms, whose first name I've forgotten, who were the doctors, and there probably were one or two other female doctors. The other group of people would have been nurses, who would have been very limited numbers of them. They were trained nurses, usually general nurses, who would be in charge of the wards. The ward orderlies actually were psychiatric nurses, but they were ward orderlies because they weren't members of the RCN, and so the nurses were officers, and their male counterparts, who were ward orderlies, were NCOs and privates. So fantastic, interesting ramifications. And then, of course, you had the women coming in very often from the NAFI. They were running the NAFI. They were coming in bringing... cigarettes from local voluntary organisations. So Cadbury's used to send in women bearing gifts of chocolate, and for a lot of the younger women, it was quite an exciting time because they were surrounded by 800 young men. 600 young, well, 800 because you had to talk about this. So it was a smattering of women. And their experience would be a really very interesting one to follow up. Unfortunately, I don't think enough of them are alive to do so.